Hello there, and welcome to In Your Own Kin. I'm your host, Charlotte. I'm a lover of great food, sometimes artist, sleep-in advocate, storyteller, mama, and postpartum professional in Naarm, Melbourne. Each week, I'll be chatting to families about their journey into parenthood, the grandest of adventures. Parenting is beautiful, messy, sparkly, hard work. You were never meant to do this alone. It's time to get comfy in your own kin. In Your Own Kin acknowledges the traditional custodians of the land where you are listening to today's episode. I pay my respects to elders past, present, and emerging, and recognize that the telling of stories has happened here since time immemorial. In Your Own Kin is recorded by the Birrarung on the lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. Sovereignty of these lands has not and is not ceded, and it remains stolen. This always was and always will be Aboriginal land. In this episode, Rachel reflects on her parenthood journey and adventures with her partner Tristan and their two children, Eloise and Dion. Oh, this one is such a beauty. Rach weaves such magic with her words, so perfectly capturing the beauty, brutality, and huge transformation that comes with this season. Rach covers so much ground in this episode, managing, as always, to shine light on those aspects of motherhood that so often remain unspoken, doing it with such warmth and generosity. We talk about creating your village and identifying your kinship support network, her two very different birth experiences, the wild and wondrous nature of postpartum, sexuality and motherhood, ritual, ceremony, and matrescence. This is one you are going to come back to time and time again. I am such a huge fan of everything that Rachel creates. It was such an honor to be able to sit with her and listen to her story. Here's Rach. Thank you so much for joining me on the show today, Rachel. Honestly, this is such an honor. I'm such a huge fan of your work, and I've been so looking forward to this chat for the longest time.
Oh, thank you, Charlotte. I always feel a little weird when people say that, and I think I really shouldn't have named my Instagram The Rachel Rose, because I am not a celebrity. I am just a regular human being. And yeah, whenever anyone says they're excited to talk to me, I'm like, okay, cool. Why? But anyway, I'm really happy to be here.
Would you like to let everyone know a little bit about you, where you're living and who's in your family?
So I am currently sitting in my beautiful backyard studio in Wollongong, which is on Darawal country. And I live here with my partner of almost 10 years, Tristan, and our two beautiful children, Eloise, who's almost 5, and Dion, who's almost 18 months. And we moved to the South Coast about 6 years ago from the busyness of Sydney, and just love it so much and would never go back.
The tree changes, it's not its tree change, it's a sea change, but I love that country change. We've done similar in the last year, and honestly, it's just the best life, isn't it?
Yeah, it's both. It's a sea and a tree change being in Wollongong, because we've got, yeah, the bush surrounding us and the escarpment and then the ocean. And it's just a really nice place to raise kids and set up a life here.
Yeah. What makes your heart sing, Rach?
Oh, so many things. Women working with other women, talking about transformations and transitions and huge life experiences like birth and postpartum and being a mother and sitting in circle spaces with women. I love talking about both the transformation of motherhood and the growth opportunities, and then also like the shadow stuff and the darkness and how hard it is. I love having real conversations over endless cups of tea. Yes. I just love being around other wonderful humans with children in the mix as well. That makes my heart sing.
Oh, me too. So special. Talk to me about life pre-parenthood, Rach. Talk to me about life when it was you and Tris.
Yeah, so we met in Glebe in Sydney, he inspected a house that I had a room going for rent, and I decided that I thought he was pretty attractive, so I didn't want to give him the room, but I wanted to make him my boyfriend. So I was working in the music industry at the time, so that was pretty cool. I could say, do you want to come to this concert? I've got free tickets. How rad am I? So he came along to that, and then we had an on and off kind of relationship. I was in a recovery program for an eating disorder in my early 20s, which is when we met. And so that recovery and that healing and that eating disorder, which was linked to broader trauma related stuff, really was the kind of mark of our relationship for at least the first 4 years. He didn't really know what he was getting into with that, but came along for the ride. And so, yeah, developing our relationship out of that space, yeah, it was tricky, but I was really committed to getting better and to getting well. And so I was in and out of recovery programs and doing what I could to do that. And then I got to some level of healing. I mean, I still, you know, I don't even know what now, 20 years down the track from when my eating disorder first began, and I still have remnants of it, but mostly I feel well. And it really just kind of springs up at certain stress points, like the pandemic, for example. But yeah, being with him in that time, there was just a lot of deep feelings that were happening and getting to know myself and really rediscovering who I was, what my needs were, what my interests were. A lot of my early life had been kind of clouded in this food and eating and trauma obsession. And then I was working. I've always worked throughout it. I've been a really functional, high functioning, I should say, person living with complex trauma. So I've always worked, and I was working in the music industry, and then I moved into the charity sector and fundraising. And so I used to organize charity challenge adventure based trips, like around the world. So some of our relationship, I was really heavily into that. I get quite obsessed in the things I'm passionate about.
Yeah.
So that was raising money for organizations like UNICEF and World Vision and breast cancer organizations, and then doing some trips myself, like going to the Great Wall of China or cycling across Cambodia and Vietnam. So it was quite a fun, wild early 20s, and then wanting a career change again, thinking, okay, what I want to do is something to do with social justice, something to do with, transformation and healing. I'm going to be a teacher. So that's what I thought was the thing. So we moved to Wollongong so that I could do a master's degree. We bought a house down here. I loved the learning aspect of being a teacher and, you know, just learning about the theories behind learning and how children's brains work and how, you know, education can be such a pivotal way of moving through social systems and escaping certain social systems. But then the reality of doing my prac, I realized that, oh, actually teaching is quite fundamentalist in how it is entrenched in Australia, and also there's not much wiggle room to really do what you want to do. So I then became pregnant when I was 26, and in my thinking it was just like, I'll just, you know, have a little break, maybe 6 months off, and then I'll go back and I'll finish my master's degree. And teaching is a really family-friendly career. That will work fine. Because, you know, the concept of these hours of like you go into work at 8 and you finish at 3, but you don't really think about the fact that teachers work so many hours outside of their actual jobs, and they're away from their children for 5 days a week looking after other children. It's not actually as family friendly. So I became pregnant, and very quickly my entire world was flipped upside down because I got very sick with my first pregnancy, and my idea of just working throughout the entire pregnancy as well as studying as well as having a social life, just disappeared basically overnight. And I spent most of that pregnancy just laid up on the lounge, vomiting into little plastic bags and feeling sorry for myself. So that was a fiery initiation into expectations versus reality as it is.
Yes.
And also just, you know, I've been very driven, very motivated by working, formed a lot of my identity around who I am and what I've been doing at the time. And I feel like that was just that kickstart into that matrescence period, into the total upheaval, because no longer could I say that I'm the woman that commutes 2 hours a day, works, then comes home, studies at night, you know, gets the HDs in her degree, is super successful. I was successful in other ways, but what that looked like was just, you know, being on the lounge and growing a baby from scratch.
Absolutely. And my gosh, that is big work.
Yeah. And I can talk about it like this now, but in the time I wasn't feeling great about it. I was like, this is fucking awful. Who am I? Tristan, I had encouraged. We've been very great, Tristan and I, in encouraging each other in doing our passions and following our dreams. And at the time for Tris, that was working so different to what he's doing now, but for a multinational corporation in the medical industry, traveling around Australia Monday to Friday and sometimes to New Zealand. So he would be getting up at 3 a.m., driving to the airport, going away for days at a time. And, you know, I thought that would be fine when I was pregnant because I wouldn't have a baby. So he didn't need to be around. We could still maintain that lifestyle and he could be doing that while I was growing our baby. But it was so challenging for him to be away for those stretches of time when I physically couldn't make food for myself. You know, opening the fridge would make me gag and sometimes vomit. And also we just moved to Wollongong. So because I was no longer able to commute to Sydney and be at work with my 20 female colleagues who were great friends of mine, not only was my partner away, but my social structures and my socialization was just ripped away from me. And so I was just by myself in a new town watching TV, which didn't feel very great, and thinking, what have we done?
Yes.
It's got to be up there with the worst life decision we've ever made.
All right.
Yeah.
It's so freaking hard when you're in that space.
Yeah.
Did you have physical or emotional support, or were you truly just in the haze?
I could have reached out more. I didn't. It's been an ongoing lesson in meeting my own needs and asking for help. And I think people also, I mean, yeah, I'm even doing it now. You kind of have rose-tinted glasses on your pregnancy experiences.
Yeah.
And so both my mum and my sister had had vomiting and nausea throughout their pregnancies, but they had been, you know, 5 years before and then 30 years before. And so they weren't really able to meet me where I needed because it just wasn't in their awareness anymore. So I would get text messages of emotional support saying, yeah, it's really hard, but they also live an hour away from me and they have both my mum and my sister work. No one's retired, that kind of thing. And then my mother-in-law, who has been a wonderful support to me over my mothering years, she lives 2 hours away and she was there for me so much when my daughter was born, but not so much in the pregnancy because, you know, I didn't know to ask and it would be a big thing to be asking, oh, could you please drive 2 hours up to sit with me while I'm sick on the lounge kind of thing. Yeah. I didn't even think that was something I could do. And then I didn't really have any friends down in Wollongong. We knew very few people. I had met a few connections through my master's degree, but they were mostly younger than me without children. So just, you know, you don't know what you don't know. And again, the social connection was quite new. So it would have been, it wasn't like that deep level of comfort in a friendship where you can kind of ask and feel like you would get what you need. And then my Sydney friends, they would text and that sort of thing. But again, it's a big deal to drive 2 hours to sit with a woman on the lounge.
Yeah.
And I had a doula. I did book a birth doula and I did book a postpartum doula. So I was very like, yeah, you need support for birth and postpartum. And I'll invest in that for then and I'll just like get through this. I'll just keep chugging and I'll somehow survive and then it'll be great in postpartum because I'll have support. So I really, you know, I work with women now and a friend of mine was really sick in her pregnancy and I said, you don't have to wait. Like if you're going to be investing in your care after, why aren't you doing it during?
Totally.
She then went and got a mother's helper. She then went and got food packages and that kind of thing. But, you know, there's also finances that come into it.
Absolutely.
When you are sick for such an ongoing period, and at first I thought I'll get better at 12 weeks. That's when it will happen. Oh, okay, I'll get better at 16 weeks. That's probably when it's going to happen. Oh, I'll get better at 20 weeks. I always thought it would change. And then also 9 months is a very long time to be investing in our external support. So I just don't think we maybe could have done that financially. And also I wouldn't have felt like I could have done it in terms of like, I deserve to do this. So yeah, it was a very fiery initiation. That my pregnancy, though, has been one of the biggest catalysts for what I do now in my work in terms of community building and women's circles and really having that drive and that bigger why as a connector for other women and people in my community. Because I know what it's like to not have it. And I know what it's like to not have it for no fault of my own. It's, you know, I didn't deserve to be like that, but also it was no one else's fault either in a way, like it was all a muddle. And so that's a huge reason why I talk so much about connection and forming community. And if you can do it before you even get pregnant, the better.
Oh, absolutely. We go into this thinking that pregnancy sickness, well, first of all, we go into it thinking it's morning sickness and that, you know, then you can have a piece of toast and you're on your way and you're all good. But for so many of us, that is not what that looks like. It's all consuming hell. And I think if you know that you can speak about that openly or at least get that heads up, it makes such a difference because otherwise you're just up in your head miserable.
There's something wrong with me. I'm doing this wrong. And, you know, I had lots of fears too about being sick and was the baby getting enough? And then I chose to go down a route of having medication. And even though I called the Mother Safe Helpline probably a dozen times and they said the same thing every time, I would call just be like, maybe they're going to say something different and I've, you know, done the wrong thing. Like I had a lot of anxiety around what I was taking. Was I going to harm my baby? I will say that I was doing weekly therapy. And during my pregnancy, sometimes I was doing twice weekly sessions. So that is something that I had been doing for years before that already because of my eating disorder and my trauma background. But, you know, that was $300 a week sometimes if I was doing twice weekly sessions, which is just a huge financial outlay. And therapy is not necessarily going to be the right thing for everyone, but for me at that time it was. And so, yeah, trying to find money and resourcing to do other things outside of that, it was just too challenging.
And how was your relationship with Tristan at that point?
It had both. So we had the excitement of the idea that we were going to have a baby together and that we were becoming this family unit. And we had moved to Wollongong and was starting a garden and we got chickens. And so there was that. It was beautiful. It was beautiful to see my belly grow. We had lots of pockets of really lovely connection points. And then also distancing, the resentment of the fact that my life had changed so dramatically overnight, whereas his was the same. The tension between him still doing his work and traveling. And, you know, he, again, so different to who we are now, but he was like a corporate flyer. So he would be in the corporate lounge getting all the fancy food and, you know, just having so much time to himself. And then he'd get these massive food allowances when he was traveling and he'd go out and take himself out for a huge steak and a bottle of wine. And, you know, I didn't want to hear about that stuff because I was not able to eat anything that I enjoyed. I ate a lot of hot chips and gravy,
which,
you know, I do enjoy that. And my daughter, who I was pregnant with, loves them as well. So, you know, maybe there's a link. But, yeah, I would say it bred some resentment and some challenges, and it forced us to have really serious chats about what we wanted to do with our future and with our lives and our work. And it was pretty clear that he couldn't continue that job if our family was going to thrive. And so he made the steps over that pregnancy to stop working for them, even though it was a massive paycheck and, you know, had all of these bonuses. And so eventually he did get a job locally in Wollongong about a month before we had our baby. And he's just about to finish up there next week. So he's been there for the last 5 years. So, you know, even though there was challenges, it made us look squarely at what we needed to do, which was a good thing as well.
And how were you preparing for the birthday? Were you preparing for the birthday?
I thought I was in some way. Yeah. I didn't have a lot of energy, really. I've always been someone that loves reading and loves research and loves learning, but I didn't have a lot of that capacity to do it in my pregnancy just because of how fatigued I felt and that sort of thing. But in my eyes, I wanted to have a natural birth is the language that I was using at the time. Now I would say I wanted a physiological birth. I wanted to have a natural birth, but I wanted to have that in hospital. And I thought that was something that was, you know, pretty possible to do, because why shouldn't it be? Why shouldn't you be able to have a birth as physiology and nature unfolds in a hospital? You know, hospitals are supposed to be the safe places where we do this. That's where everyone births. So, yep, I'll book into my local hospital and do that. My partner had been born at home, and so had his younger brother. So my mother-in-law had spoken fondly about home birth, and I've kind of flagged the idea with my partner at the time, but he was working as a medical professional, very entrenched in that sort of system. His father is a doctor. Even though he was born at home, he had come to the idea that hospital was best. And honestly, it's not like he said no and I was, you know, really sad about that. I was very on the edge as well, like not really committed to that idea, just thought, oh, maybe that's something we could do. No, okay, no, we don't need to do it. Yeah. So it wasn't like it was a clash in our relationship or anything like that. And I probably wouldn't have had the mental preparation to really go through with that anyway. So we booked into the hospital, but I wasn't able to get into the midwifery group practice. So I was just in antenatal shared care with a GP. I changed GPs a number of times because of various reasons, including that I was told that my BMI was too big and, you know, all of these things, even though the doctor said there was no medical indication for why that was an issue, just that she was concerned I wouldn't be able to lose the weight after I had the baby. And so, as someone that had an eating disorder, that was a red flag for me.
Absolutely.
So I was kind of floating around in that space and just still thinking, still hoping to have a natural birth. I did a she birth course. So we went to Bondi and stayed in Bondi for 2 days and really learnt all about physiological birth, which was illuminating. I didn't know very much. You know, I wasn't a doula before I had my baby. So it was like a crash course in just everything. How do the hormones work? How does the birthing body work? What kind of moves do women do? Like, you know, I didn't know much at all. So that was handy. But again, a lot of that information is really geared at if your labor starts spontaneously. Whereas when I ended up having an induction of labor, so much of that had kind of gone out the window, and I wasn't really prepared for a birth with intervention. So much so that when I did the hospital birthing classes as well, I chose not to go to the night where they would speak about pain relief options and interventions and cesareans and inductions. I didn't want to know because I just, that wasn't going to be my experience in my head. So yeah, I was kind of teetering on that line and just really not understanding the reality of how the hospital system works as an entity. And the policies and procedures that are commonplace and not personalized and not something that I needed to take so personally. If I could have zoomed out and realized that these are cultural and social policies and procedures versus something really about me and my baby and my body, perhaps it would have unfolded differently. But I didn't really know. I didn't know how it all worked. And so I wasn't prepared in that sense. I was naive, I would say, it shouldn't be naive that you just want to have your baby without interventions, but just in a room that happens to be in a hospital.
Yes.
But yeah, it really ramped up towards the end of my pregnancy that it was going to be almost a battle to be able to get the things that I wanted to see that birth dream unfold. And ultimately it didn't unfold in the way that I had pictured or planned at all, as is the case for many, many women.
Oh, I'm nodding vigorously along with you. And the way you say battle is so powerful. I feel that at my core because it sets us up for like a really challenging postpartum period if we've battled through a pregnancy and then we battle through a birth. We're already entering like the most transformative period fighting with a guard up.
Yeah. Yep. And it's a lot of unnecessary energy that's expended. Absolutely. When so much of that time should be focused inwards and honing into your intuition and understanding your needs and your wants versus just trying to placate, play the game, fight against other people that, you know, are doing things not because they're evil, but because they're operating within the limits and structures of this system as well.
Absolutely.
Which has become the way it is because we live in a patriarchal culture and we see doctors and the medical system as the experts versus women and babies. And, you know, midwives and doctors that work within these systems are entrenched in the culture, are unable to have their own wiggle room and, you know, do what they would like to do as well. And they're also just seeing birth in a very different way with lots of interventions over and over again until it becomes so normalized that they cannot imagine birth to really be any other way. So, yeah, I found myself really in that space of we don't trust your body and this pregnancy to keep going. I gestate longer than 42 weeks, which even if you go beyond 40 weeks in Australia, it's, you know, you're already facing a battle of an induction of labour. And at my hospital at Wollongong, there is a 55% induction of labour rate for first-time mothers. So that is incredible. And I say that not in a positive way, but the number of women that are having that conversation and then having their labours induced cannot be right in terms of they were all medically sound reasons or evidence-based reasons. And I found myself, yeah, really in that space of we don't trust it, we need to manage it, we need to get you into this system so that we can kind of plot your labor and progression on a timeline from here on out. Like if we induce a birth, then we kind of know how it's going to unfold and we kind of know what interventions we're going to need across that birth span. Whereas if we have every woman and person turning up in spontaneous labor, the system would cave because there would not be enough staff to ensure adequate care. And, you know, if we let physiological birth unfold as it wants to, it doesn't attach to a timeline. It doesn't look how it should look on paper. And so it would be complete and utter chaos. And so I know that now, and I can understand and appreciate that. But at the time, I just thought that I was being victimized and that they were doing this to me, and that it was just very traumatic. It was very traumatic those last few weeks, being told that my baby might die, having dreams about birthing a stillborn baby, you know, trying to push back and not really getting the whole picture of information or research. And then ultimately deciding that, okay, let's go ahead with an induction of labor, not really knowing the entire risks of that choice as well. And then also just feeling deep within me that it wasn't the right choice for me. I always knew that. I always felt like it was fine to wait, but feeling like my hands were tied. And so just deciding, because it was the path of least resistance in that stage.
Yeah. It's a lot. It's a lot to carry, isn't it?
Yeah. And I see it time and time again with other people that I work with and in pregnancy circles, just hearing this. My story is not unique.
No.
It is actually the most common story. And, you know, I want to make it clear that I'm not anti-induction for medical reasons. Sometimes an induction will be the absolute best path forward.
Absolutely.
For you and your baby. But when we have 55% of first-time mothers having their labors induced, I think we need to ask more questions.
Yeah. Absolutely. You touched on something that I want to go back to a little bit, and you mentioned trust and feeling like there wasn't a level of trust in your ability from the health professionals to birth the baby that you were growing perfectly. How were you feeling about your body at that point?
Yeah, it's interesting. And I think too, reflecting on my pregnancy, again, I put rose-colored glasses. I was who I was in that first pregnancy, and that was someone who was still pretty deep in recovery for an eating disorder, which by and large is a distrust of a body.
Yeah.
And a rebellion against my own body and lots of self-hatred and self-judgment. So I was still deeply within that. But I will say that apart from feeling miserably sick, I had a huge sense of awe and wonder in my pregnancy about the fact that I was growing this human from scratch. And I did feel a sense of love and appreciation for my body in the way that it was changing shape. I felt really quite comfortable growing larger and larger for the first time ever. I loved having a belly. For me, it felt like the first time it was acceptable to have a belly, which, you know, I don't believe that, but that's my mindset. But I did feel some distrust in why I was so sick. Like, oh, am I just not cut out for this? So there was that, like, in the background. But I trusted birth. I never really had this sense that I couldn't birth, that I didn't have a storyline in my family or my red thread where we don't or we can't give birth. I didn't have a story that we repeat, you know, patterns that, you know, I'm going to need to have a cesarean because my pelvis is too small or something like that. You know, there are sometimes these family stories that we hold. I really trusted birth. My sister had had two physiological births. My mum had birthed me at over 42 weeks and I was almost 5 kilos, and she birthed me in the hospital without pain relief. And she was like amazing. The star of the show, and everyone came in to see her because she's tiny. She's a tiny statured woman. So that was kind of my knowing of birth.
Yeah.
But it was uncomfortable territory to gestate beyond my due date and then to gestate beyond 42 weeks. I felt much, much more comfortable in my second pregnancy. And like, I didn't have any fears really about that particular aspect. So yeah, there was a dance. There was a trust in birth. There was a desire to have a natural birth. But there was also lots of complicated history with my body.
And during my pregnancy, I went into hospital for, you know, I thought I hadn't felt movements in a while. And some of that was definitely linked to just some general anxiety that I was carrying in my pregnancy. And when we were in there, there was a picture on the wall and it said something like, imagine your cervix opening like a flower. And so I'm pregnant. I'm about 30 weeks pregnant. Mm. And I turned to Tristan and I said, Tris, where's my cervix?
Mm.
And he laughed because he's like, ha, ha, ha. And I was like, no, where's my cervix? He's like, Rach, how do you not know where your cervix is? Like, you're a woman who has a cervix and you're about to have a baby. And he had to explain it to me. And I think part of my eating disorder and part of my history, which includes sexual abuse, was a disconnection from that part of my body. And just, you know, there's also the cultural, like, we're not really taught about our bodies, but also absolutely. I think there was just me never engaging with that part of my body, me never engaging with my menstrual cycle, me never really thinking about what are these names of these places within me. So, yeah, can a woman who doesn't really know where her cervix is have a natural birth in the hospital? Probably not.
Mm.
And it probably all unfolded the way it was going to unfold anyway because of who I was and where I was at that time in my life. But it was the catalyst of huge change and then a reckoning and a getting to know my body after the birth in postpartum and then in the 5 years since.
Yeah. Talk to me about your birthday with E. You've shared your birth story, so I'll make sure I link to those, but take us there. Take us to the birthday.
I'll just do a sort of short version of it.
Yeah.
And look, it's I say that I've spoken about my birth story a lot of times. I want to give everyone permission that you can tell your birth story as many times as you need to. And
yes.
Every time you tell your story, you will find new gold in it. And
yes.
The way you process and understand your birth experience will change 1,000 times over your lifetime.
Yes, a million yeses.
And it's quite timely because just on Friday, so a couple of days ago, I had a holistic pelvic care treatment and this was my second one of these and it'll make sense how I relate it to the birth. But that is where you have someone else with their fingers intervaginally and they do trigger release points and scar tissue massage. And then there's manual adjustments on the outside in terms of moving your body in your uterus. It's amazing care and hardly anyone is receiving it. But what came up for me was my birth from almost 5 years ago. And I thought, wow, I've still got so much stored in my pelvis, in my womb, in my cervix about that birth. And I thought I had processed it to the nth degree and spoken about it and done so much writing and healing and journaling and everything on it. And it's still there. So that's really powerful just to remember that, you know, these are pivotal life experiences that stay with us in some way, shape or form. And in different times, different things will surface.
Yes.
So what came up for me in that session was around, yeah, just the many times that I had people's fingers inside my vagina and feeling like my birth started that way, which it did because I had prostaglandin gel as my induction of labor method. And that kind of comes with a package deal of then having cervical examinations and then it linked on further to having syntocinin and an epidural. And I labored really powerfully and beautifully and in lots of loving support from Tristan for about 12 hours. I was moving around the room. My eyes were closed. I'm really thankful that I've got a few photos from that time where I can see that I was doing that dance of labor, you know, going off to another place in that different plane of consciousness. And, yeah, that was beautiful and I'll always have that and I get to talk to my daughter about that and, you know, swaying and moving and being in the bath and really trying to move through those contractions, but at the same time feeling on edge, feeling on a timeline, and also just having had my labor start in a way that didn't feel good for me and my body. and had me quite in a heightened state. I didn't know my midwives on shift at all. They were brand new for when I transferred across to the maternity unit, birthing unit, I should say. And so it's just, you know, that standard care in Australia, not really knowing who is going to be there with you as you walk through that fire of birth. Yeah. And that's really disorientating because for so many people that will not instill a sense of safety. But I was lucky. My midwife was beautiful and, yeah, she held and safeguarded that space for those sort of 10 hours, 12 hours. But there was lots of external pressure that she was receiving every time she was leaving the room about, you know, more vaginal examinations, not progressing fast enough, what should we do next, that kind of thing. So zooming out, I can just see the amount of pressure that she was on as well. And so my birth did end up unfolding in me feeling like I couldn't do it any longer after having a vaginal examination that said I was a certain centimetres dilated, and then in my brain thinking, well, if I'm that, it's going to take me this time again, another 10 hours to get to potentially where I'm birthing, which is just not true in terms of how the cervix dilates. It's just not something that we can chart. That's a really outdated method. Yeah. So I had that crisis of confidence, and that's when I opted to have an epidural. I had Syntocin to keep the labor progressing because at that stage I'm on a bed, not moving anymore. I was really exhausted. And look, I really appreciated the epidural at that stage. It helped me relax. It helped me get some rest. My partner Tristan had something to eat at that stage. But, you know, it was the beginning of a highly medicalized birth. The lights came on. There were more people in the room. When you're not really feeling their sensations, you're taken out of that real heady labor space where you're in another world. I was suddenly like very aware of my surroundings, able to have full conversations. And I think it also invites a certain level of conversation from the care providers as well. Whereas in the first 10 hours, it was very quiet. It was hush. The lights were off. Everything was done in soft tones. When I then had the epidural, it was bright lights, conversations, just like we were, it was an everyday kind of party sort of thing. And so I was not able to kind of stop battling, unfortunately, in that I had an obstetrician that wanted me to have a cesarean. And so every time that they would leave the room, it was this, what are we going to do? Like, how are we going to have this baby without having a cesarean? And I say we, as in the midwives were kind of saying, what can we do to facilitate this vaginal birth that you want? It's no longer a physiological birth, but how can we, you know, get it to as close as to what you dreamed of? And so that just meant, you know, pushing against my body, not really knowing when and how to do things and feeling rushed and just on edge and stressed. But eventually I pushed my beautiful baby out while that doctor was out of the room and felt utterly triumphant and overwhelmed and in full joy to receive her on my chest and just to feel like I'd done it. And I did feel like I'd done it. Every part of me birthed that baby, epidural or no, on my back or no. It was me and, you know, I did it. So that was wonderful and beautiful. And by that stage, we were sort of given some peace and quiet finally to just sort of meet our daughter. And she was super pink and alert and just, you know, really bright from that moment. And then unfortunately it was, you know, six hours after the birth and we were about to transfer to the maternity ward when I was breastfeeding her and I had a postpartum hemorrhage. And that was really difficult and challenging. And that's also what came up for me in my pelvic healing session on Friday. Just, you know, at one stage I did have a sense that I may die. And so to sort of leave my body and to see my baby being held by my partner. And, you know, I talked to lots of women about the primal wounding of that separation of mother and baby when we don't get to have our babies on our chest. And, you know, it was 5 hours after the birth, but I still felt that. She wasn't with me. She was taken off me and she was being held somewhere else. And I was also feeling like I might not come back, like, you know, I might die. And it wasn't true. That wasn't the reality as it was. It wasn't that extreme, but certainly just I had that feeling. And so when you have that feeling, that can land just as traumatic as if that was the reality of the situation. It was very rushed in the room. I had things done to my body without consent because of the, I guess, emergency side to it, and just being held down on a bed while this was all happening. My saving grace of that moment was a midwife who held my hand and made eye contact with me. And she had a hand, she was holding my hand, and then she had a hand on my shoulder, and she just looked me in the eye and she said, "You're going to be all right, Rachel." And so I just maintained eye contact with her and breathed. She also recommended that I sucked on the gas just as a way to like keep me calm, because it was painful as well. And so I was doing those things, and I was seen to in that space without needing to transfer to theatre and that kind of thing. So that was hugely challenging after, and I felt like it took me back into that fight and that birth space of like things happening to my body, me not being in that center of control. And really interesting, like my partner and I had been very strong about our boundaries. We'd had lots of conversation about postpartum, how we didn't want anyone to come to hospital. We weren't going to pass our baby around. We weren't going to have any visitors. It was just going to be us. We were really sure about that. And then I had that hemorrhage, and both of us were like, we need to call our mums.
Totally.
So, yeah. We called our mums, and both our mums came straight away. So Julie traveled 2 hours. My mum traveled an hour, and they met us in that birthing unit. And because in that time, I just felt like a little child. It felt like such a huge thing that I'd just gone through, and I needed my mum at that time. So they came and were just with us in that immediate after blow of that traumatic event. But look, I left the hospital saying my birth was amazing and telling everyone that it was awesome and that my care team were just the best, and they looked after me and they saved my life and they saved my baby's life. And I think some of that was the high hormones of just going through that kind of transition. But then also there was a huge part of me that felt that my identity was tied into this idea of having a natural birth and that it didn't unfold that way. And so I had to keep painting this picture that I felt really good about what happened anyway. So it was kind of years of teasing out that birth experience, and then becoming a doula, learning more about birth, learning more about the hospital system, where I could really see that with fresher eyes and understand how certain things, why they happened, and, you know, what the meaning of certain things were. But yeah, if I take myself back to my immediate postpartum, I came home and I was just like, every person that gives birth is a rock star. That was insane. I cannot believe we all do that.
Like, how is that possible?
I need to apologize to every person, woman in my family that I have never said, "You're amazing. Like, you gave birth.
You got us."
So it was that both end again. It was a huge mix of feelings, like triumphant, trauma, joy, sadness, all of it rolled into one.
Oh, yeah. Let's talk about support. What was support looking like in that early postpartum period?
I had been to a preparing for the first 40 days workshop with a local doula.
Amazing.
And yeah, in it she had said something like, in the first 6 weeks to 12 weeks, you might be breastfeeding for up to 10 hours a day. And I was like, what in the world? Are you serious? How am I supposed to do that?
But what about this list of things I thought I was taking off on my maternity leave?
Yeah. Am I going to be continuing my master's degree? Like, I'm going to just start.
So I hired that doula, who I had done prenatal yoga with as well when I could go. And so that was always the plan. We would have a postnatal doula who would come for 6 weeks and bring meals, and she would also give me a massage and then just be there for emotional, spiritual support as well. Her name is Bryony Goodsell, and she is amazing. She's one of the reasons I'm a doula today. Just her loving care. She had 3 children of her own plus 3 stepchildren. So she was a mama of 6, and I just loved her energy. She's, I think, about 10 years older than me, and I just saw her as kind of, you know, she knows it. She gets it.
Yeah.
So we had Bri booked in, and then that was pretty much the extent of it, to be honest. My partner having started a new job just before I had our baby meant that he wasn't in a position where he felt comfortable to ask for more than he was entitled for in terms of carer's leave. So he had the 2 weeks. And because of my post-birth complication, I was in hospital for 6 days. And so then when he came back, we had barely any time together in the house, and he was back at work full time, which was really hard. My mother-in-law did come. I can't really recall if she started coming weekly from that early, but my mother-in-law has been a huge support of mine and has come regularly, weekly, and stayed the night and always brought a meal with her. And then just, she is one of those dream postpartum visitors in that it's not about the baby, it's about the baby too, because she's like a doting grandmother and is obsessed with her grandchildren. But also, she would never take the baby off me. It wasn't about holding the baby, it was about being with me in the space, and then, you know, cleaning up the kitchen or putting a load of washing on or just doing things around for me. So that was wonderful. But, you know, distance is hard in that it's hard. Something that has to be planned. She can't just drop over. It's, you know, if I've had a really rough couple of nights, it's not like she can just be there, which she would be if we lived in close proximity. My own mum, she works full time, so not really available. She did what she could, but it was a different flavour of support and not super regular. And then I had friends from Sydney who would travel down and kind of sit with me, and if any of them are listening, I love you. But they had not had children themselves yet, and so they did what I did before I had babies, which was just come and hang out, and you don't really understand what you're meant to do or what you're meant to bring, or you hold the baby and you take a photo with the baby and it's really cute and fun. Yeah. But in some ways that can be draining of energy, and it can also overstimulate the baby and all of that kind of stuff. So I had pockets of that in the first 6 weeks, and I had intended to do, you know, a first 40 days like lay-in, which I think are wonderful, but when you don't have that aspect of community care, that is a vital piece. That's why traditional intact communities have all of those first 40 days or 3 weeks or 6 weeks. It's because they also have the community care as just a necessity, and you would be having people coming into your home to provide connection, provide support, provide bodywork, provide food. So when we're trying to piecemeal all of these things together, because we have a postpartum physiology that requires this kind of care, but we're missing pieces, it doesn't always work. So that's, you know, again, how everyone says we need to eat warming foods. That is what our physiology requires. But then if you're at home and you can't, then eating something is better than nothing. Absolutely. And so we just have to work out what works for our circumstances. So I had a cleaner also. I had a baby shower in my first pregnancy, and I'd asked for money. And so I'd received $1,000, which was amazing. So I booked a fortnightly cleaner for as long as $1,000 lasted. Meals-wise, I don't think we were organized really at all, but we did have some friends drop some things around, and my mother-in-law would cook for us, but we ate quite a bit of takeaway as well in that time, just because I thought I would be able to be back to cooking a lot earlier than I was. And really, it took me like 18 months before I could solidly be in the kitchen again, because I had a baby that I baby wore all the time. She was not a let me put you down baby at all, as
is normal, but it makes it difficult to be in the kitchen and that sort of thing.
Absolutely.
Yeah, so that was our planned support, and the massages were amazing, and Bryony coming were amazing. But again, it was only 3 hours of the whole week. That's a lot of hours in between. I'm so glad I had it. I still felt like it was super overwhelming and challenging, and kind of felt like I couldn't complain because I had a postpartum doula. But at the end of the day, that is just one small part of your entire week when you're working 24 hours with a baby.
Oh my goodness, yes. You touched on matrescence in pregnancy. Let's go there for postpartum. How was your identity shifting at that point?
Yeah, I really loved being a mum. Not everyone does, and not everyone sinks into it that easily, but I feel like I really, really enjoyed it. I found surrendering to who my baby was okay. My baby needed me to hold them for all of their naps. I had some resistance around bed sharing. I had my own thoughts around that wasn't safe. And so I had to do relearning around co-sleeping and bed sharing and safety and that sort of thing. And in my first week, I was timing feeds because we had used formula and I was expressing and I was kind of in that regimented feeding schedule. But eventually that settled, and then I was feeding according to her demands and according to her needs, and got into a rhythm with that. So that sort of fell into place fairly quickly, I would say. And I felt like it was the pregnancy. I really resisted the rest component of the pregnancy. And perhaps that was because I didn't have a baby on the outside. But when I had my baby, I fell into the rest with more ease because it was like I could do it for her, or I had a legitimate excuse finally. And as someone who has always been busy, always working, or never shuts their brain off, I was suddenly in this completely different space and energy, really more in that altered state of consciousness, in that oxytocin-fueled, empathetic, brain foggy, can't string a sentence together but secretly loving that. Totally. Let's just have luscious, long, you know, nap. I didn't nap. No, I wasn't good at that. But I would hold my baby in my arms and just stay on the couch. And I kind of surrendered into that quite well, considering who I am, especially for the first 6 weeks. I was like, at least for the first 6 weeks, I can do this. It got harder as she got older. But yeah, I had a huge reality check in my idea that I would be able to just hand her over to someone else when she was 6 months old and go back to uni. Yeah. I thought I would just put her in childcare. My mum was an early childhood educator. I have fond memories of childcare myself and preschool. I had been studying to be a teacher, so I thought, you know, that's a part of early education. But the closer it got to 6 months, I was like, no, for me, I just cannot. I also deeply loved breastfeeding. Once we got over our initial challenges, and they were quite significant and it lasted a while, but once we hit that 12-week mark and breastfeeding was easy, I loved it. And she just breastfed so much. I was like, I cannot logistically work out how I would leave her for long periods of time. I had no desire to express and use bottles because breastfeeding was working so well for us. So yeah, I had to defer my uni, and I deferred it for another 6 months. So that was quite a big thing, just to be like, okay, I'm not the person that I used to be, and it's not going to be as easy as I thought it would be just to sink back into work. My boss, who I loved, and she's this powerhouse, but she had had twins at hospital and was still emailing me during her labor. So that's kind of the work ethic she has. She was a CEO to our company. And so she asked me at 8 weeks postpartum if I wanted to come back to work, but I could work from home. I could do it however I wanted to do it. And I just said no, like I can't. My brain is not up for that. I don't know how I would do what I was doing, which was the charity challenge stuff, which required a lot of like logistical operations management, keeping lots of balls in the air at the one time and figuring things out. I just thought, I don't know how.
Yeah.
How?
Yeah. There are only so many post-it notes one can have up. Too many lists.
And, you know, she probably could have slept in my arms while I did that, but I didn't want to. And so that was another just, okay, I'm different now. Okay. And I just had this deep passion lighted around birth and motherhood and social justice. And it was kind of like the amalgamation of all of my passions prior to that finally landed in a way that was really tangible. And that was motherhood and how we don't value motherhood and how isolating it is structurally and socially, and also how important it is raising babies. And learning about attachment and learning about how babies' brains develop and learning about the history of things like sleep training and the separation of mothers and babies, and also just thinking about my feminism and how it had been so skewed to working and where, like, how I had degraded motherhood as its own right as well. So just lots of questioning around all of my values and belief systems, and pretty early on seeing that I was obsessed with this space, but not really seeing it as a career change, just really learning everything that I could for my own benefit and for my own pleasure, and meeting other mothers in my community, which was just the joy of the first year of my baby's life, was making really tangible connection in Wollongong through my baby being that link point to meeting people. So yeah, I had a huge, huge discombobulating period. Lots of stuff around my sensuality, my sexuality, my being in relationship, what sex would look like, how we would navigate our roles, who would do what in the household. And I did return to uni when my daughter was 13 months old, and I remember the first day just feeling like, why isn't anybody asking me about being a mom? And don't they know that I'm a completely different person and I don't want to talk about this shit anymore? And
totally.
They don't get it. Like, I'm completely different. And I was thinking about my daughter as I'm sitting in this busy class, and my breasts started leaking, on spraying, and they still do that. And so I had this like physical representation of the tie between my daughter and how much we were connected and how different I was. And I'm back in this sterile room about to give a speech on some, I don't know, educational theory, just thinking this isn't who I am anymore. So
that can feel like that push and pull can feel so like tricky. How were you navigating that?
Oh, just messily.
Yes, ditto.
Yeah, like a baby deer learning to walk, like, you know, just figuring it out as I went along, and you know, resisting it as well. Like, I didn't make the decision to quit my uni degree because I had a full scholarship. We'd moved to Wollongong. I was going to be a teacher, and I was bloody good at the learning part of it. I'd stood up in front of a room of like 500 teachers and told them how I was going to be this teacher, and I got this scholarship attached to it. Like that's what I was going to do. But I didn't quit that until I had landed in doula work and gone, actually, there is something in this that I can do. I don't just have to be obsessed about this as a hobby. This could be something that I do as work. And then in terms of my relationship, like, we've been together almost 10 years now, and parenting has brought up the best and the worst of us.
Yeah.
And it's just a constant communication. And sometimes there's no communication for weeks. And then we have to have a meeting because we need to sort shit out.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm no better at it than the next person. It's just figuring it out as it all unfolds. But I think I will say that being connected in doula spheres and meeting like-minded mothers who were giving time and space to the matrescence period and kind of not ignoring it and acknowledging that it was a thing, even knowing that it's a thing is the first step.
Yeah.
Being able to have countless conversations with my mother friends about what we were going through has been how I've learned so much and reflected on my own life so much. It's through those conversations and through that connection.
You touched on something that I would love to go back to because I think so many of us are like, take us there, let's talk about that. And it was motherhood and sexuality. Talk to me about that.
Yeah. In my first pregnancy, I mean, sex wasn't something that was really on the cards much at all because of the nausea. So we went long periods without sex in the pregnancy itself until I was trying to naturally induce my labor in quotation marks. And then I was like, have all the sex with me, which is really glamorous and attractive when you're like 42 weeks pregnant. And have ignored your partner for the 9 months prior.
Yeah.
But anyway, he was a good sport. In the postpartum, look, I was just so taken up by the magnitude of mothering and the intensity of it and how much someone else needed me and my body and breastfeeding and bed sharing. I had very little left over to give to another person and not to myself. Like I'd had a healthy relationship with myself and my pleasure, and that just kind of disappeared. And I got my menstrual cycle back early both times. I've had my period back at 8 weeks postpartum. So I'm not sure that I have the hormonal element to place blame on, not blame, as a logical reason as to why sexuality can wax and wane is that we have hormonal differences when we're breastfeeding. But for me, I don't think that's the main part. I think it's really just it feels, excuse me, all consuming. I just felt like my touch cup was filled to the brim and I got so much loving connection from my daughter that was non-sexual, that was just like sensory and luscious in all of its ways and forms that I didn't really need anything else. And then my partner, who's working out of the home, he's not getting that touch needs with the baby because he was away for so much of the day. But part of that, it was beautiful that we had bed sharing in our family because they could reconnect at night just by being in the same room together and being next to each other. But, you know, he wasn't getting any of that kind of oxytocin touch needs filled up. And so there was challenge there. And, you know, if you asked him, he would be quite open that he was also kind of operating out of that kind of adolescent patriarchal view that, you know, sex is something that needs to be in the relationship and sex is something that relationships have to give to each other. I don't know how to explain that properly, but just that there was a natural need and he should be able to. Not that he ever put pressure on me, not that he was ever saying this, not that he was ever, never have we had any forced kind of sexual intimacy in our relationship, but he was going through this in his own head about how does that unfold and what is a relationship when there's no sex happening and, you know, what does that mean for me as a man and all of that kind of stuff. He was working through that. And, yeah, in our second pregnancy and postpartum, he'd done all that work. And so we have flowed a lot better in this postpartum. But then also potentially maybe because of that work that he's done, because of me not feeling like it's something that I need to give him, and that was my own stuff as well, not coming from him, my own history of being with partners that have been like that, history of just knowing that that's kind of how women are seen. I've unraveled so much of that. And so it hasn't felt like
a taking of. It's more yes. like when we are intimate now, it's a giving and receiving together.
Yes.
But it was probably 18 months to 2 years with my first where we weren't connecting much at all. Mm. We did have sex at the 6 week mark because I thought that's what you had to do,
mm-hmm.
but I didn't want to. And so that was a giving over of me. And then we played around with it a bit in that first year, but really I didn't have much energy, didn't have much time, didn't have much inclination. And then from 18 months to 2 years, my sex drive came back, and it came back, and I would say then sex became even better than it had ever been. And I felt like I had kind of been initiated into more of my sense of womanhood and my yeah. sense of connection with my body. You know, I didn't even know what my cervix was.
Yeah.
And then I've given birth through my cervix. And so pleasure was amplified once we were able to come back to each other, and I felt like I was having sex from just a different space, like the yeah. the death of my maiden, she was gone, and now I was having sex as like a mother. And so it got better, and then, you know, got better and better and over time. And then my pregnancy with my second was like, whew, juicy, the juiciest I've ever felt.
Yes.
And then when I gave birth, everything disappeared. And so I'm back yeah. in that space in like, this is my second matrescence, second time dealing with this sexuality thing.
Mm.
And it felt like just I was a cardboard box after I gave birth, and I lost my ability to orgasm. And some of that is linked to some pelvic dysfunction that I'm going through. So some pelvic challenges, and yeah, just again, now I've got two kids, and so I'm all consumed in that again. And we connect when we can, and there's communication around it, but there's still frustration on both sides. It's not easy. And I'm just holding hope that it will return in a bigger way, but it's not going to happen without me really reconnecting with myself first.
Yes.
And I think there's been some blocks around that because I've got some trauma-based stuff that I need to work through in the pelvis. Yeah, so that's jumping around to both. But I can just say, for me, it's, I don't lose hope. Like, I've had the experience now where it's been all turned back on, and I believe that will happen again. And at the moment, I'm just deep within this stage and phase of my baby cutting molars and mm-hmm. you know, learning how to talk, and that takes a lot of me and my body.
Oh, absolutely. And it shifts, and the changes shape so darn quickly.
Mm.
I think second time round you have a bit more faith in that, right?
Yeah.
You touched on your second pregnancy. Talk to me about how you were traveling in that second pregnancy. In Dion's pregnancy, how were you feeling physically and emotionally?
So that pregnancy was a surprise. So the initial part was quite emotionally turbulent, just because it wasn't, we were always going to have another baby, but the timing just wasn't quite how we planned. And it meant shifting lots of things around in our personal and professional lives. And so it was a whole thing. But, you know, just having women friends to talk to about all avenues was really healing and hopeful for me in that stage. Mm. And then once the decision was made that it was what we were going to do, I felt really excited. I felt really just, oh, like I get to give birth again, but this time it's going to be on my terms. And I'd done so much work in between and had learned so much. And it was an immediate, we're having a home birth, no ifs, no buts, let's book that in. So the private midwife was like the second person to find out I was pregnant.
Yeah.
I was dreading feeling sick again and how that would impact me and my business. And I'd already said yes to be a doula to a couple of women. And, you know, just that knowledge that I might be sick played heavily on my mind. I was sick, but not for as long, not vomiting nearly as much. I didn't take medication, and it all kind of eased at 20 weeks. So I was able to get through that pregnancy physically a lot easier. Mm-hmm. It was a lot more enjoyable. The first trimester was rough. Like it, I was laid up on the lounge and really nauseous and that kind of thing. But I had space to do that, so I was able to. And my daughter was 3 when I became pregnant, just before 3. So I weaned her from breastfeeding, and that was challenge. That was an unexpected emotional challenge to deal with in that pregnancy, because it's just not something I had wanted to do. But we got through that. You know, she was old enough that she could understand that I wasn't feeling well. And look, we watched more TV than usual and played games. I've got videos where I would just give her my wallet and she would just take everything out of my wallet and put it on my head. Like whatever game I could play from the lounge, we did, shopkeepers, that kind of stuff. I gave her texters. She would just draw all over my body. Like, fair game, whatever we can do while I'm on the lounge. And my partner was working full time up until the end of my first trimester. So that was hard, and it kind of took me back into that lived experience of the first pregnancy, feeling unsupported and But then he shifted to 2 days a week while studying. So he had more time at home, and that helped immensely. Mm. He was able to prepare a lot more food for me. He was able just to be there with our daughter. She was also in preschool 2 days a week, which helped. It meant that on those days I could just lay and relax and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I found my pregnancy emotionally challenging. I do. I think they bring everything up to the surface for a reason. Mm. And it's not necessarily a bad thing, but I don't blossom through pregnancy. I don't particularly enjoy it in the moment. But when I reflect back on them, both of my pregnancies have been such great transformative periods of my life with such wisdom and stuff in them. So I just get through it. And I had a doula this time, but I got a lot of pregnancy support. So we had like 6 sessions together in pregnancy, and they were ritual-based sessions where they were really marking the sacredness of the pregnancy, and she would bring food and we sometimes meet on the beach, and they were just beautiful. So I felt really supported in that way. I felt supported in my prenatal care, in that it was just very relaxed, very trusting, like so trusting. It was just like we would just chat about other things and drink tea. It wasn't, there were no fears or concerns from my midwife about me or my birth or my previous birth experience. Mm. It was just, you know, you got this. Of course you've got this. So, yeah, the pregnancy unfolded as it did. I was working up until the maybe 6, oh, no, I attended a birth when I was 38 weeks pregnant. So I was working for most of it, but it was my own work at this stage. Mm. So different to working for someone else full time, I was able to set my own hours, and I played around with it constantly. Can I do this? I might need to cancel that, that kind of thing. So, yeah, that kind of took me through the pregnancy. Then do you want me to talk briefly about the birth?
Yeah, let's hear Dee's birthday.
I was 42 weeks and a couple of days, so very similar to Eloise's.
Yeah.
And, yeah, I was really impatient. I did feel like I was losing my mind, not necessarily because I thought I was doing the wrong thing or it was dangerous or there was anything wrong with being past 42 weeks, but it's just also a very long time to be pregnant.
So long. So uncomfy by then.
Yeah. And it's not the cultural norm. And so things do come up for you when you're doing things against the cultural norm. And I just had to live in that space. I was deeply physically uncomfortable, very heavy, didn't really have any juice left to do anything with my daughter. So it was just like, can I just have this baby so I can rest again? So just going through the motions there, but I had had a mother blessing. I had my pregnancy during the pandemic, so it was all of those things that anyone would know had happened during the pandemic: isolation, not being able to access certain things, stress, anxiety, all of it. That was happening in the background. But I've thankfully been able to have a mother blessing when restrictions eased, although I could only have a small number of women there. And I was just texting them pretty much every day in those last couple of weeks, being like, give me a pep talk, do this, like just like, you know, love me. I need love. Someone come and sit with me. And so that was amazing. And, you know, such a difference
it was very healing to have that community and connection that I had built so intentionally over the years in between my pregnancies, to know that I had people who I could call on. And so I went in, I entered that birth portal feeling really excited and loved and held, and labor kicked off at 9 o'clock at night. And I tried to labor on my own. I did labor on my own for a few hours while my family was sleeping, and just felt so excited and giddy that it was happening, and it was happening spontaneously, and it was happening at home. And I mentioned that I had had such a juicy pregnancy. So I self-pleasured in my early labor. I'm like, I'm going to have this orgasmic, beautiful, blissful, ecstatic birth. Yes. Because I'm not at the hospital. So, you know, I can just do whatever I want. Like I'd said to my midwife, I'm probably going to masturbate throughout my labor. Just don't make eye contact with me while I'm doing it and we'll all be good. You know, I felt comfortable to say that to my birth team. I felt like I'm just going to have these amazing women in the house, and I'm going to be really connected to that goddess energy and juiciness, and it's going to be so sensual and beautiful. It wasn't like that.
I love it.
It was hard. I found the contraction surges painful. I did not feel like I was riding waves of ecstasy. I felt like I resisted every one with every inch of my brain space. And I certainly made it harder on myself because I was so in my head comparing my labor to other women, just couldn't switch off that logical thinking brain, still trying to run logistics in my brain. Mm. But at the same time, that is who I am, and that is how I birthed, and it is how it was supposed to unfold. And so my labor went for 21 hours, even though I was banking on having maybe a 3 or 4 hour labor. That would be nice.
Yes.
It was long. It was painful. It was hard. I cried a lot. Mm-hmm. I felt like I was releasing not only my own trauma in my pelvic space, in my body, in my life, about being trusted and in control and all of these things, but I felt like I was releasing stuff for other women, and maybe some stuff in my family as well, some childhood stuff. Every time my doula came back to sit by me, because I'd asked not to really have them hovering around, they were going to be in other rooms, she just said the masks were falling away, and I was just becoming more and more that little girl, that inner child. And I found it hard and confusing, and I asked for help, and I begged, and I wanted it to stop. Mm. And, you know, I laugh though, and I've told this story in many different ways, and I talk about how much I complained and how noisy I was, and then I check it out with my birth team, and they're like, no, you actually weren't, and you didn't complain that much, and you didn't say that much. And I was like, oh fuck, that was all in my head. Like so much of it was just words that I didn't actually even say or express out loud.
So wild.
And I met up with my second midwife last week, and she describes the noises I was making as like rhythmical, beautiful, melodic, like lovely noises. And my doula says my birth was like super gentle, and like it unfolded just like as a textbook, beautiful, gentle birth does. And here I am thinking like I'm like screaming the whole time and just so angry and begging for it to stop. But a lot of it was just in my head. And, yeah, I couldn't vocalize, I guess, the sensations that I was feeling. But in saying all of that, like I never felt scared. I never felt in danger. I had moments where I'm like, this is taking too long and this is wrong and the baby's stuck, but I didn't actually believe that. Mm. I just wanted to be rescued. And so I was trying to come up with different ways to like position myself so that someone would make it stop and rescue me. Mm. But I didn't really think that we were going to need to transfer to the hospital. I was fantasizing about pain relief, but, you know, it was what it was, and that's what I needed to do. I just needed to resist it and be in that emotionally challenging space. Yeah. And so I would labor in the
the birth pool, and that was kind of gentle and lovely, and that's why I stayed in there for so long. But every time I'd go to the toilet, it would be like a volcano of energy, and I would be not into that. So I was willingly going, you know what, I don't want to feel what's happening on this toilet. I'm going to go back into the shower. I'm going to go into the pool. I'm going to go walk around. And so, yes, my labor could have been 3 hours if I'd stayed on the toilet and just let that volcano rush through me, because that's where Dion was really finding his way in the birth canal, making his way through. But I didn't want that. So I kept going into the safety and the cocoon of the water and just being in that space and breathing and moaning and making noises and crying and weeing in the birth pool 100 different times. I'm so aware that you're supposed to wee in labor, like you don't want to hold on to your wee. But I didn't want to go back to the toilet. So I'm just like,
no one will know. It'll be fine.
No, actually, they all knew, because I'm like, can I wee in the pool? And I'm like, yeah, you can if you want, but you can go, I'm weeing, it's happening. Don't worry.
The glamour.
And so eventually, by like the 20th hour, I had said, like, what am I doing anything wrong? And everyone's like, no, you're not doing anything wrong. Everything is perfect. It's beautiful. It's fine. But I was getting really tired by then. I hadn't slept. And so it was suggested that I go back to the toilet, and I just had to face that and go, oh, that's everything I do not want to do. That pain is everything I have been fighting for the last 20 hours. But I have to do it to birth my baby. So I got out of the pool and I held on for dear life as I'm in transition from the pool to the toilet, just begging, like, can't do this, can't do this, can't do this, won't do this, no. Get to the bathroom, I look in the mirror and I'm just a shell of the person I was the day before. But there's no escape. There's no out. Like, I'm the only one that can birth my baby, and no one else is going to be able to do it for me. And so I have a contraction that feels different in the toilet, and I feel a pop, and then it's just on from there. And I just have this involuntary urge to bear down. I'd been having that a little bit in the pool, but a lot gentler. And just kind of doing this counter pressure where I'd squeeze the muscles in my bum to counter it. But this was just like, whoa, need to hold on. And if anyone's seen my birth photos, I'm holding on for dear life, because I just felt the birth energy go from the crown of my head just all the way down. And it just pushed that baby out as I screamed. And I think I talk about screaming and crying in my labor, but nothing was like those screams of birthing my baby. And that was the energy that I needed to meet him. It needed to be that full force, let go, get out of your head. This is the primal scream of birth. And it wasn't until then, it wasn't until I fully surrendered to the pain and to the noise and the movement that I needed to do, and I could never replicate those noises again in my life. That's when I got to meet him, and my partner stepped in to catch him, and my daughter was watching, and everyone was crying, and it was in full, beautiful control, and just so overwhelming at the same time, and so awe-inspiring, and when we got to walk into the bedroom, I'm carrying my baby like I'm an absolute warrior. And we got tucked into bed and birthed the placenta about an hour later. Breastfeeding was a dream from the beginning. And my postpartum, I know we don't have that much time, but my early postpartum was gorgeous. And, I didn't have any syntocin. I had lots of syntocin in my first birth, and they've done studies that link that to postpartum anxiety and depression. And I can say that have the difference between having a birth in the hospital that had trauma physically and emotionally versus a challenging birth at home, but on my own terms without trauma. The healing was incredible. My emotional state was amazing. But also I had my partner off for 7 to 8 weeks. Huge difference.
Yes.
And breastfeeding worked well from the beginning. So I didn't have any of that stress over my postpartum time. And we just really got to sink into it and receive from my community. I didn't want to put up a meal train because I didn't think I could ask. And then inadvertently everyone just made a meal train for us.
All right.
Yeah. I'd filled my freezer with 3 months worth of food. Bit manic, bit over the top. But we honestly didn't cook for 3 months. So
good.
You know, it was chalk and cheese in terms of postpartum experiences. And it was still challenging. It still had its moments. I still had, you know, the emotions arise and feeling like, oh, this is a lot to hold. I've got to have a baby on me at all times and we don't sleep much, but it was very different. And then this gentle, beautiful boy that I birthed over 21 hours, he was also completely mellow in the postpartum and surprised me by being able to be put in a bassinet and just sleep on the bassinet on the table for sometimes 2 hours, which
this was a dream.
Exactly. So I got more pockets of time without him on my body. But at the same time, I think the biggest challenge of that postpartum was the transition my daughter went through to be a sibling and just navigating big. And holding that for her. Yeah.
Talk to me about, it's big, right? Like, my gosh, what a journey. And it's such an interesting thing to like sit with it and talk about it in this way. Like, it's such big energy doing it in like a block like this. Talk to me about family life now.
Yeah. So my partner has quit his job finally. That's been 2 years in the process of winding down. And the idea is that we will both co-parent a lot more squarely and fairly now that we are able to. I'm still breastfeeding. My baby's going to be 18 months in a couple of months. So there's still a biological reality that I bed share with him and I am with him and need to breastfeed him, and I don't want to give away some of that.
Yeah.
But I want more space for my own work as well outside of motherhood.
Yeah.
And so we're just trying to navigate how we work it out for our family, that we're both getting our needs met. And that will look different at different times, and it won't always be 100% fair. But also my daughter has just not been thriving at preschool, so she's no longer at preschool and we'll be homeschooling her. So we are very intentional about having our home as our base.
Yeah.
And parenting from that place, but also very aware that we're not a village. My partner is not a village. I'm not his village. And we need to create a lot more support and systems in place to be able to make this dream a reality that doesn't see us collapsing in a heap and hating each other. But I love toddler stage. So we're about to really hit that toddler stage. And I just love seeing my children grow and develop and the ways they mimic you and the words they start. So I'm really looking forward to that. But that comes with, you know, disrupted sleep, full-on days, lots of busyness. And I'm just aware it's just a constant renegotiation of like what we need to do to support each other in the family. And I found the last lockdown really, really challenging. I felt like my mental health was on thin ice. And we're only a couple of weeks, month, I don't know anymore, out of that lockdown. And that's going to have long-lasting ramifications and consequences on our family and everyone's families for longer than just now. Like, I'm still having to replenish my stores and my energy and figure shit out after that horrendous ordeal.
So
it's exciting and it's also overwhelming, and I don't want to idealize homeschooling or idealize co-parenting. Like, there's lots of ways that it is challenging to the relationship and to our levels of sleep and all of that kind of stuff. So now my next phase is building more community. That's what I go to when I feel under-resourced. It's like, okay, I can't do it all myself. Who can we know in our homeschooling community? Who can we get in for child swapping and babysitting and maybe paid care? Like, what are we going to have to do to make this work? So that's the next phase I'm in.
Yeah.
Oh. Weaving it all together and sinking into the knowing that we probably won't have any more children. So how can we just, make this the best it can be while acknowledging that we're living in modern reality?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, my gosh. And the strangest of realities at the moment, it's a whole other beast to be sitting with. Oh, Rach, I'm so looking forward to watching your story unfold over the coming months and years. I'm so in awe of everything that you're creating for your family.
Oh, thank you. Special. And I will say before we finish, we are very privileged financially. We have received an inheritance that has allowed us to make decisions like this. And I think it needs to be stated, because sometimes people would look at what we're doing and think, how in the hell do you do that when you need to, pay for your mortgage and all of that kind of stuff? And so I just want to make it clear that we're using the privilege that we have and really trying to do good work with it for not only our family but for the people that we work with in both of our businesses.
Yes.
But I have to acknowledge that we are in a financially privileged position that most people are not.
Rach, if you could go back to yourself 5 years ago, 6 years ago, what would you tell yourself?
Don't make five-year plans. Your life will not look like how you think it will. Like everything, there's no way I could have dreamed or planned that this is how it would all look like. So don't make plans. Strap yourself in for the ride and try and just enjoy it while also acknowledging that it's hard.
Totally. The best, wildest, most wondrous ride of all.
Absolutely.
Oh, Rach, it has been such a delight. Thank you for sharing your story and for speaking so openly and honestly. It's been, an absolute privilege. Thank you.
Thank you, Charlotte.
It is such a joy to share these stories with you each week. If you're enjoying the show, be sure to subscribe, leave a review, or share it with someone in your very own kin. You can see all of the gorgeous images of the families that join me each week and get the latest news from Kin on Instagram @KinByCharlotte. I can't wait to chat with you next week. Mm-hmm.